devoured one of the best meals of my life. She had brewed an exotic mix of herbs and spices, infusing the meal with an ancient, delicious flavor of something part Asian, part Arab, and part African. The rice, lentils, chicken, vegetables, and homemade bread permeated our senses. We ate and talked for hours. This was a treat for us all, a high-risk treat. It was the first time I had ever ventured inside an agent's home. We learned more about each other. Understanding and trust grew, but that was a byproduct of the primary reason for the visit, a need to upgrade our communications. After midnight, I unpacked the communications gear that I had lugged all afternoon in my backpack. This was the equipment, stored in a special concealment panel of the cooler, that we had slipped past the customs officials the previous day. Our agent immediately grabbed the gear from me and started his inspection. A brilliant Renaissance man who understood a number of languages, he was a connoisseur of both ancient philosophy and modern communications technology. He knew more about the equipment than I did. We discussed how it should improve his ability to communicate with the CIA. A prolific collector and writer of intelligence residing in a remote and distant town, he needed to communicate daily. His previous system was on the blink. Our techs wanted to repair it, but I persuaded them to provide us a better system, one that had been proven reliable. I did not want them to go back and forth repairing the old system. More trips meant more risks. We needed something that would last. The agent and I crawled up the pull-down ladder to the hatch in his roof. We popped out and crawled along the roofline to the old antennae, concealed among a string of old telephone lines. The agent connected the wires and we scuttled back along the roof. I briefly looked out over all the homes and the tropical landscape out to the sea. Only a few homes had lights shining this late at night. A couple of cook fires flickered along the beach, perhaps somebody grilling fresh lobster or fish. There was no traffic. No noise except for the soft wind sifting through the palms and the alleyways. "Hurry, let's go," the agent ordered. Then he looked around and saw the view. He looked back at me, grinned like a madman, nodded his head, and ducked into the hatch opening. I followed. After another 30 minutes of labor, he had it all connected and broadcast his first message on the new gear. It worked. We stayed another hour, drinking hot tea and enjoying their company. We discussed more politics, reviewed his collection requirements, and planned our next meeting several months later. After he checked outside his door, he stepped back and embraced us. Cindy and I eased into the dark and beautiful night. Walking back to our rented house a couple of miles away, I told my wife, "You are great." She said, "No, but they are great. So is the dinner. The flavors. When do we go back?" The communications link lasted for years. So did our agent. Cyberspace. The relative simplicity of my earlier operations, some more than 25 years ago, now seems almost quaint when I consider the breathtaking diversity and complexity of newer technical projects driven by quantum leaps in imagery, communications, and robotics. Yet these monumental advances in technology have not necessarily made collection easier. On the contrary, in some ways, technical collection is much harder because of massive amounts of data, new requisite skills, diverse operational risks, organizational challenges, bureaucratic competition, archaic law, uninformed politics, and social norms. In spite of these hurdles, technical collection, especially when combined with effective human-t operations, has proven sometimes wildly successful, but enormous consequences flow from these advances. These technical changes profoundly affected the National Security Agency, NSA. Founded in 1947, NSA built a global network of collection systems to snatch data transmitted through the atmosphere. At NSA headquarters, thousands of brilliant officers deciphered, translated, and analyzed the intercepted texts. Culling through millions of messages over decades, NSA produced unprecedented reporting, both in quantity and in quality. The advent of cyberspace, however, challenged NSA's collection abilities. With more collection targets producing more data transmitted in more ways, NSA struggled to reinvent itself, pursuing SIGINT not only in the atmosphere, but also in fiber optic cables and in databases. In a slick leverage of vocabulary to expand its authority from dynamic atmospheric interception to static terrestrial collection, NSA called this targeted data SIGINT at rest. This push for NSA relevance, of course, encroached on the CIA's HUMINT turf. Using human sources, the CIA had been stealing computer data since foreign secrets first landed on a hard drive. The CIA had been filching foreign intelligence from cyberspace since its inception. During the span of my career, there would be no greater intersection of technical and human collection than in cyberspace. In late 1995, the CIA became concerned that it might not be ready to exploit the rapid expansion and utilization of advanced technology in various target domains. The agency created the Special Project Staff, SPS, to study this looming challenge. The SPS included key intelligence community partners and customers in the review. The principal finding of the study confirmed that the CIA was not prepared to seize the collection opportunities in this rapidly emerging high-tech environment. The SPS recommended the creation of a new office to tackle these new targets. The office, dubbed the Clandestine Information Technology Office, CITO, would report to both the Clandestine Service and the Directorate of Science and Technology, DS&T. The CIA approached Dr. James Gosler, a big-brained Sandia National Laboratory mathematician, to become the first director of CITO. He eagerly accepted. Dr. Gosler quickly developed a knack for clandestine operations, and he envisioned a critical role for line operations officers like me. In fact, he was adamant about the differentiating operational capabilities that could be formed through an effective partnership between the clandestine service and the DS&T. Gosler started proselytizing for his new unit throughout the clandestine service. I heard about it and figured it was not for me, but I was directed to attend an introductory course, specifically designed for ops officers with little, if any, technical training. If technical ignorance was the prerequisite, I was the most qualified in the class. I did not protest the directed training. After some reflection, I figured that since digital systems stored secrets worth stealing, some basic reference points would be useful in my espionage efforts. I never imagined what these cyber operations would mean to the clandestine service and the security of our nation. Thank goodness Gosler and others did. Designed and taught by CITO, the course emphasized espionage as the key to digital intelligence. In one of our sessions with Gosler, he noted that people were the primary access points, given that somebody held the data room combination, the encryption codes, the passwords, and the firewall manuals. People had written the software. People managed the data systems. Ops officers should recruit computer hackers, systems administrators, fiber optic techs, and even the janitor if he could get you into the right data storage area or fiber optic cable. Working with relevant experts throughout the intelligence community, including NSA, Gosler would help determine and advise what was worth targeting. His shop would provide the techs to help with the operations. Informed and enthused, as good leaders are, Gosler preached that we would be the pathfinders for the CIA's cyber offensive against an array of targets. As adversaries grew to acquire and use digital data, and as the Internet expanded, So would the CIA's cyber operations. We would be in the forefront. To reassure us, Gosler stressed that while this was new terrain, he would support us, and we, the operations officers, should focus on operations. We did not need degrees in computer science. We just needed to understand the relationship between foreign intelligence in digital form and human nature. We would exploit the relationship. That I understood. That I could do. The advent of espionage in cyberspace was nearly instantaneous. Its rapid growth and impact on our operations was stunning, even revolutionary. The scope and rewards of my own technical operations exceeded any of my expectations. The amount of raw data stolen and exploited became hard to measure by conventional standards. Instead of pages, we were now talking about terabytes of intelligence booty. By the time I entered the Counterterrorism Center in 1999, most of our technical operations were based